You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, July 21st, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
All right, fess up. Which of you guys have been playing Pokemon Go this past
week?
Oh, cool. Thank goodness I have not.
Bob plays.
I tried it.
I do it for the fitness and social aspects. That's it.
Yes, right, of course, yeah.
I interviewed Bob on my personal podcast on Talk Nerdy last week, which was so much fun. And
it was.
Yeah, he unprompted started talking about Pokemon Go.
Oh, Bob, yeah. I told you to
edit that out.
I mean, to give it my real review, first off, I didn't even get to level 5, so I didn't fight or anything. But I walked around with Steve, and it kind of sucked. You know, I'm like, all right, well, where's this, you know. You see some rustling in the bushes in the app. You see these leaves go up and you walk over and you throw a stupid ball at the thing and it captures it. I guess I'm missing all the fun, right? There's a fun part of this game, Bob?
It's a little bit more fun than you're giving it credit for. So I play with my daughters, but it also is you have to walk around to play. I guess you could drive around, but
no, it won't work.
Yeah, to get to places, it sort of forces you to walk around. Plus, you get eggs, and if you have to hatch, in order to hatch the egg, you have to walk, and driving doesn't count. You have to walk 5 kilometers, then your egg hatches. So it is designed to get you off your ass, get you moving around, get you to
that's great.
Points of interest, you have to go to points of interest in order to get more Pokeballs and stuff. So that aspect of it is great.
It's critical, I think, because I literally would not be interested, nor would I play for longer than a few days if it weren't for that. If you could just sit on your couch and have them come to you, I would lose interest so fast. So that's what I think is so key about it. Even the social aspect, which is, I think, secondary. I've got a couple friends at work who are like, hey, we just saw a Pokestop that somebody dropped a lure on. Let's run out. So we just left our job and spent 20 minutes walking across the street to do this stupid thing. It's just a fun social thing.
Yeah, I guess that's
good. I'm telling you, I'm cranking up the steps every
Exercise
day.
Exercise goes up. Productivity goes down.
I'd be interested to see how big the user base is of people who really weren't that exposed to Pokemon. Because, okay, I'm 32. I'll be 33 in a couple of months. And I'm just too old for Pokemon. It was a phenomenon that happened just maybe a few grades below me. My little sisters were into it, but I was just too old. So, obviously, Bob, you weren't playing with Pokemon when you were young.
Not that he admits to.
Not in the slightest. Like I said, my attraction is what it is to this specific game, and I had no real interest in Pokemon at all before this.
They're saying 9.5 million daily users are active.
Holy crap.
It's gargantuan. It's the biggest app in, I think, United States history, the biggest bigger than Tinder. It is a cultural phenomenon. And I think a big part of it that we haven't mentioned, I think, is the augmented reality, virtual reality aspect to it. 'Cause you are walking around a very simplified map of your town, of wherever you are. But then when you actually see a Pokemon, then actually your camera comes into play and it's like overlaid on top of whatever. I had a Weedle or whatever overlaid on a jar of peanut butter on my desk, because it's just a funny thing. So that's another component that I think is important. And I think it also shows you that this is the beginning. This is just the biggest beginning of augmented reality games that I think are just going to sweep the nation, sweep many nations.
Yeah, I think that's the real news. The real news story here is that how popular the first augmented reality game is. And this is the chumpiest, most basic version of augmented reality you can imagine.
This is Atari. This is Atari.
It's a Space Invaders.
Tennis.
Yeah.
Right.
But the smart thing is that it is a social game, as opposed to, I have a couple of really cool augmented reality, toys that, they're kind of museum friendly toys. I have this deck of cards that's a deck of dinosaur cards, and when you put your camera over it, the dinosaurs come to life. They're really cool, and also farm animal. They're for kids, but they're really exciting and cool, and they're fun. But you can only really play with them for so long, and you can only play with it alone. But this becomes this augmented plus going outside of your house plus having this whole social aspect. It just kind of fits in on the zeitgeist right now. It just makes sense for everybody.
think about the potential. Imagine wearing...
Oh my God,
you know, instead of holding your phone, imagine wearing like augmented reality, you know, pretty much wraparound goggles and playing games like Call of Duty in your neighborhood. Just imagine,
imagine right? The, yeah, so augmented reality meaning that there is a graphical overlay on top of the real world. It's not,
yeah, but you're out and about in the real world. There's something compelling about that.
Imagine the traffic. If you have like, you know, I've seen this before with kind of half VR augmented reality where you have sensors, right? You have a sensor on your outfit, you have a sensor on your toy gun or whatever. So you can basically be playing laser tag, like fake laser tag out in public, but you're augmenting it to be like Call of Duty.
Yeah.
Like, how cool would that be? That you actually have the interactive component where it's not just pushing a button on your phone, but you're playing with, like, little toy guns.
Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome.
Walking Dead scenario, that would be
just
cool.
Make sure they don't look realistic, too realistic in real life.
That's the cool thing. They look neon yellow in your hand until you put on the goggles.
Yeah, then they look
badass. Yeah.
Yeah, if you get if we could start getting some haptic feedback, you know, like when you can actually feel things.
Good word, Jay.
The you know, like they have gloves now that give a little bit of sensory feedback from a game, but it'll get better as the tech. You know, companies have to start spending a ton of money, and then when they sell billions of them, the cost will come way down. Guys, a quick update. Another number I read here that said there are 21 million daily active users on the Pokemon game. Yep. It's unbelievably huge now.
By the way, an article, breaking news right now, an article I just saw on CNN Politics. Uh-huh. State Department spokesman calls out reporter for playing Pokemon Go in briefing.
That's it. Oh. Well, that's it. It's infiltrated the highest levels.
But did you guys see this? There's some guy on TV doing the weather. Some woman walks in front of him playing Pokemon Go on camera live. It's hilarious. That's the best example yet that I've read.
That weatherman totally
fantastic.
Got fantastic.
All right, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, Carlos Juan Finlay, 1833 to 1915, was a Spanish-Cuban epidemiologist who first recognized that yellow fever was transmitted through mosquitoes. Huge, huge finding. Yellow fever, you don't hear much about it really. We know what it is. We've heard of it, but it was a horror in Finlay's time. And it still is to this day in some countries. It ravaged and haunted the tropics back then. Often, you would get better after you contracted it after a few days, but then sometimes it came back with a vengeance and with a 50% mortality rate. People were dying. A lot of people were dying. In Cuba, Finlay noticed a pattern of yellow fever outbreaks during mosquito season, and that was the key breakthrough. His theory that mosquitoes were the disease vector wasn't widely believed for 20 years until famous war surgeon Walter Reed and colleagues were sent to Cuba to research the disease that caused so many deaths during the Spanish-American War. Now, Finlay convinced Reed, and together they identified the specific mosquito species and had incontrovertible proof. And this was the first time ever that mosquitoes were shown to actually be vectors. And this ultimately led to the eradication of yellow fever from Cuba and Panama, saving hundreds and thousands of lives, and also allowed for the completion of the Panama Canal, which was taking a huge toll. And then, of course, vaccines were developed, and it's much better than it used to be. There's still many parts of Africa that are isolated. They're still getting hit with it. And there's also many reasons that yellow fever is actually increasing a little bit here and there. So another interesting aside, history books will often say that Reed made the discovery, but contrary to many similar historical examples, Reed always gave Finlay full credit for being the first to find a link between mosquitoes and disease. So remember Carlos Juan Finlay. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing arboviruses or Aedes aegypti mosquitoes.
Ooh, or Zika.
So some historians insisted on giving full credit to the white guy, even when he was insisting that, no, it really was, you know, the Spanish-Cuban who did it.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. He was great about it, even in personal correspondences. He gave him full credit.
All right, Kara, I understand the Dutch are trying to do something about the problem of replications in science.
Yes, a pilot program funded by the Netherlands Organization for Scientific Research, or NWO, which is a funny acronym, not the New World Order, was just launched with a specific goal to encourage researchers to replicate studies in the social and medical sciences. 3 million euros was put into the national fund for use over the next 3 years, making it the first ever effort, like across the world, for replication, funded by national organization. Their main focus is so-called cornerstone research. So that specifically refers to studies that are like heavily cited, that have been used to shape public policy, that are represented in textbooks and other curriculum, or that have had a pretty large media footprint. So
yeah, we call those seminal studies. That's usually
seminal studies.
Yeah,
there you go. So that Cornerstone has less a wee-wee reference in it. So I kind of like that.
Yeah.
So according to the NDO, here's a quote. The NWO, sorry, here's a quote. The pilot program replication studies focuses on two types of research. Reproduction, which is replication with existing data. The data sets from the original study are reanalyzed. And replication with new data. A data collection is put together, which is subjected to the same research protocol as in the original study. By encouraging the realization of replication research, NWO intends to make a contribution to increasing the transparency of research and the quality and completeness of the reporting of results. The pilot is not aimed at tracing falsified research results and data sets or other forms of reprehensible research practices and misconduct. The NWO hopes to fund 8 to 10 studies a year over the course of the program. Remember, that's 3 years. And although 3 million euros out of an overall annual budget of 700 million euros doesn't sound like much, it does represent a change in the way that scientists and the public are thinking about replication. So if you guys remember, we have talked about this issue previously on SGU. A few months ago, we discussed a meta-analysis showing that over half of psychology studies failed reproducibility attempts. That was part of the reproducibility project that was led by Brian Nosek, the executive director of the Center for Open Science in Virginia. He's voiced his support for the Dutch initiative, but his own findings have actually gotten a lot of pushback from psychologists claiming that their methodology might have been flawed and that there were other issues with the reproducibility project. Probably the most vocal opponent of both Nosek's research, but also this new Dutch initiative is Daniel Gilbert. He's a Harvard psychologist. Here's a quote from him in an article that was published in Nature yesterday by Manya Baker. He said, quote, "If the Dutch government wants to spend its money on research whose sole qualification is its unoriginality, then that's their prerogative. Will we learn something valuable from such research? Probably. Will it be more valuable than what we would have learned if the same amount of money had been spent exploring important new ideas? That's a difficult question to answer, but it is the critical question, and it's the question no one asks."
That's not that difficult a question to answer.
I don't think so.
I know. Yeah. It's a very cynical outlook, especially I mean, the fact that he chose the word unoriginality, I think, has bite to it. Other researchers do argue, though, that reproducibility should just be built into the publication process and it should be required before peer review can commence. But I'm definitely interested in what you guys think. I mean, I personally think that this initiative is a great step forward, and I'm not sure I fully understand why there's pushback. And I also think that, yes, reproducibility needs to be built into the publication process, but there's only so much you can do in a single lab.
You want another lab to actually do those studies. Someone else. You want someone else to do it.
We've talked about this in bits and pieces over the years on the SGU. Mm-hmm. There are lots of potential problems with the way science is conducted. There's researcher bias. There's publication bias. There's perverse incentives. There's incentives to publish new and exciting and contradictory results, and replications are thought of as boring and unoriginal and doesn't do anything for your impact factor. And so they get undervalued. Nobody wants to give them space, you know, in their pages. If you back up and think about of the bigger question, which is, as a civilization, if we want to get the most bang for our science research buck, right, we have a certain finite amount of resources, time, you know, not just money, but time and people and the things that you need to do scientific studies. We have finite resources. We want to make scientific progress as efficiently as possible with those resources. There's a certain sweet spot of balance between new exploratory research, exploring new ideas, but confirming ideas and replicating studies to make sure that the data is reliable. And I don't think that right now we're in the sweet spot. I think that there's been a ton of evidence in the last 20 years indicating that the process has shifted far too far to the new, original, exciting research end of the spectrum and too little, neglecting the boring replication end of the spectrum. And we have to pull it back to, I think, the sweet spot of a more appropriate balance between those two types of research. So, and that's why
How do we do that?
Well, with, I think, incentives, this is one way.
That's the problem.
This
there's no incentive. Yeah. Like, the culture of science and science publication is such that there's really no incentive to replicate or reproduce studies. It's not sexy. It doesn't get you a lot of cachet within the scientific community if you're not, even look at the way he said it. It was like unoriginal research or whatever.
Yeah, it's bullshit. Like,
yeah, it just makes you, oh, this guy just redoes other people's studies. He's so unoriginal. So having some sort of incentive, like a monetary incentive, is a really good one.
But, the thing is, there's something to be said for being a real expert technician at carrying out scientific studies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Somebody should be able to build a career out of just being an experimentalist. Your job is
what a cool idea.
Analyze the research that other people do, search it for flaws and weaknesses, fix it, do it better, replicate it correctly, And I have heard researchers, this is like personal communication to me, like when someone brings up, hasn't this study been done before? And the answer is, yeah, but we're going to do it right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's the correct response. Who cares if someone's done it before? I'm going to do it right. And that's what everyone's attitude should be. And it also, the concept here is that the threshold for when scientific evidence is compelling to the point where we could say, okay, this is probably true. Now we could take this as a given and move forward is a lot higher than I think most people think it is. That threshold is higher. If you really look at the evidence, if you look at reversals and things that turn, when you do take a close look at it, it turns out they're not true, et cetera, et cetera. So that the way to achieve that higher threshold is more replication. Basically, that's the primary way.
Because those replication studies that you're talking about that actually do get published are so rarely pure replication studies. They're usually, like you said, original research where part of the methods was that they replicated previous research in order to show that the protocol works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so even then, like, it gets buried. It gets lost because that's not the pure point of the publication. But I think this is a step in the right direction. I think it's cool that the Netherlands are doing that. I also think it's really cool that this like agency has 700 million euros to just give to scientists to Dutch scientists for their research. It's so cool. But I do like that they said, you know what, we're taking money out of the main pot and we're specifically earmarking it for this because it's gotten to the point where we have to do it. We just have to.
But anyway, Jay, you're going to tell us about an exciting new breakthrough.
There was a study published in the journal Nature Nanotechnology. So on 7/19/2016, Dutch scientists at Delft University claimed to have created an atomic hard drive. Awesome. Very, very cool. Before you start getting ready to throw away your existing drive, Evan.
Okay.
This drive exists only in the lab. It's not ready for prime time, meaning, there's one. They're using very expensive equipment, and people like us won't probably ever get this drive. But there's some cool things about this, and then we'll talk about, what this news item really means. Today's best data storage is good. It's a lot better. We have SSDs coming out. But most people are still using spinning drives. You have the big metal drives that have the disks in them that are spinning around. Or, you get an expensive solid-state drive, which has no moving parts. It's like a really big thumb drive, and they're very fast, a lot faster than a spinning drive. But everybody is crying about data storage problems on their phone or whatever. We just don't have enough data storage. Now, their drive, the scientists that had this breakthrough happen, their drive actually moves around single atoms, which, wow. The technical info behind this drive is that it can store a single kilobyte of data, 8,000 bits, in a space under 100 nanometers across. Perfectly meaningless to people like us, except Bob. But to give you a real – Bob goes, wow, like right on cue. To give you a real-world understanding, this technology can store every book that ever existed on the size of a drive, no bigger or thicker than a postage stamp. Check that out, right? I mean, come on. Wherever you're sitting right now, you should have leaned back and said, wow, that's amazing.
Got the and happy chills.
In case you don't know what a stamp is about the size of a 1x1 centimeter piece of paper. Right, the other half of our audience sat back and went, wow.
And if you don't know what paper is, why are you listening to a podcast?
Right. Now, the drive that the scientists are using, when they call it a drive, it's a stationary thing, which I'm about to describe to you. It's microscopic. It's not as big as a postage stamp. You can't even see it with your eye. That's how small their drive is. Their storage density is about 500 times better than what we have today. Researchers were placing chlorine atoms on top of a copper surface, and they made a grid with the chlorine atoms. So if they were to add or remove an atom from the grid, it represents a digital one or a digital zero in really, really simple terms. That's how they did it. That's how they simulate drive. Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. The big deal, Bob, it's not this big, oh my God, they came up with this unbelievable thing. It's how do they do it? What do they do?
It's not the concept. It's just the technology to manipulate single atoms at that level.
Yep. Well, you would need like a proximal probe, like an STM, a scanning tunneling microscope, but that's a big honking device.
I know. Let's talk about it now, though. But that's what they're using. And of course, we're not going to have tiny versions of that on our desks in our lifetimes. That's not going to happen. What I do think, though, is this is important. And the reason why we talk about technology like this is this lab with these scientists might not be iterating their thing down to something that's scalable and doesn't need to be in a clean room and doesn't need to be at liquid nitrogen temperature, which their drive does on all the things I said. But it's the very beginning of just proof of concept. We actually do have a drive that we moved atoms around. We stored this is the other cool part is they took Richard Feynman's There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom lecture.
Yeah.
Where he discusses how there's tons of potential technology to be developed on the atomic scale.
That was the beginning of the first real serious proposal that I'm aware of about nanotechnology right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I think you're right, Bob. Oh. And they also stored –
I know I'm right.
Charles Darwin's On the Origin of the Species. Wow. Anyway, they also stored Charles Darwin's On the Origin of the Species, and they proved that they could write the data down, that they could store it, that it'll stay there if they leave it alone for a little while, and that they could read the data. Now, that in and of itself, on the atomic scale, that is a feat.
Yeah, it's just it's a proof of concept type of news item. Yeah. And it's just, the interesting bit about it is how much data could you store once you have the ability to store it at the atomic level, where an atom is a bit. What does that kind of information density look at? 500 terabytes per square inch is what it looks
nice.
Like.
Nice.
Yeah, that's amazing. Nice. Yeah.
That fits easily
that's
in your
half
pocket.
That's half a petabyte.
Yeah. Yep. Of course, in a few years, it'd be like, 500 terabytes? That's nothing.
Nothing. Bob, we're heading for the yattabyte.
Yeah, we are. But, questioning again, how much data storage do humans actually need? Like, we're going to start doing
Pokemon Go?
A lot. Gosh,
but think about it. Today,
laptop is always full. I have to delete files every time I sit down to record SGU.
Oh, my gosh. Yep.
Yeah.
It's a little extreme.
You need a new hard drive.
I need a new hard drive. Mine's only 250 gigs, but it's 250 gigs is constantly full. And I'm offloading to my terabyte hard drive constantly. Almost full.
We're going to get to the point soon where we're going to be recording our lives. Our entire life.
Absolutely.
More so.
And 4K at least. I mean,
maybe
our storage,
8K.
Our storage, maybe even 10K. Our storage requirements are just going to shoot up as high as they are now. They're just going to get much, much bigger.
Yeah, the bottom line is that whatever storage we have, our applications and use expand to fill it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that there's no end in sight for that because, as you say, we're just scratching the surface in terms of video and super high density, imaging and et cetera. So I think it's we'll take it, dramatically increase the amount of hard drive space we have, we'll fill it. All right, guys. Well, you guys have heard about the Kinectome project, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, we have some of the first really updated data from it, recently published, is a map of the human brain, the connections of the human brain, published, I think just today as we record this, or yesterday in Nature. So what they found was that they were able to identify, this is reviewing MRI scans and fMRI scans of the human brain, trying to identify discrete regions in the brain. What makes a brain region discrete? Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same kind of cells making the same kinds of connections to other parts of the brain, right? So if you have a clump of cells that are all sort of organized the same way, the same type of neurons, and they're all making the same connections to other parts of the brain, then we consider that a discrete region.
Okay.
Guess how many different discrete regions they found in the brain?
10 million.
Four.
Little high. Little low.
Little low. 180. 180.
180.
Is that a lot?
It's a lot more than we thought, than we had before.
So the previous estimate was 95. And this is, so not quite twice as many. This is 180.
Almost twice as many.
Yeah. Well, Steve,
did they identify any new cell types? Because what I've been reading a little bit about it in terms of optogenetics, there's lots and lots of different types of cells and subtypes of cells. Mm-hmm. It's not just neurons. I mean, there's lots of variety there.
Well, I don't think they've identified any new kinds of neurons, because that's the kind of classical, just dissecting the brain and looking at the neurons under microscopes and, staining them to see their shape and their connections, et cetera. So there are many different types of neurons that make different types of connections in the brain. And then the other main type of cell is the astrocytes, which are the support cells. But as we've learned in the last decade or so, they actually participate in modulating neuronal function. And so they're involved with, storing information as well.
Aren't they glial cells?
Yeah, well, astrocytes are a type of glial cell, yeah.
Okay, all right.
This is similar. We talked about this being the connectome project being similar to the genome project. What's interesting is that when you're mapping the genome, it's digital, right? I mean, there's an A, T, G, or C in each position. And once you've mapped it, you've mapped it. You know what I mean? There's no issue with resolution. Either you have the information or you don't. But with the connectome, even though we've mapped the entire brain, we're just getting started, because it's all about resolution. This is just increasing the resolution with which we've mapped the connections to the brain. But there's definitely a lot greater resolution that we can get to. We may not identify significantly more discrete regions, but we will learn more and more about the connections that those regions make and the functionality, how they functionally wire together and work together. And this is, this may help us. I mean, the goal of all of this is to help us understand how the brain works, right? How does it encode information? How does it modulate function? We see different parts of the brain lighting up when people, do different tasks, but it's hard to interpret that because you really need to think about networks, and the same discrete region or module in the brain might have different functions when it participates in different networks, So it's really complicated. But having a map will definitely help us in that retry to understand, what those connections are and what they do. So it's cool. Very cool research.
Good stuff.
So, yeah. This is just, I think, the beginning of a lot more to come with the connectome, understanding the human brain. All right. Evan.
Yep.
You sent me this interesting article about HARP. In the Business Standard, which I had to see if that was a legitimate news outlet or not. Well, it's funny, but, Business Standard abbreviates their name as BS.
But Steve
wasn't filling me with confidence. But tell me about it.
All right. Well, actually, they picked it up courtesy of the Press Trust of India, or PTI, which is a legitimate, well, for as much as it can be, a news outlet. So that's where they pulled this from. And here's how the headline reads. Okay, U.S. developed weapon system may cause global warming. The government of India warns. Okay, So HARP, right? When I say HARP, I'm referring to the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, HAARP.
And didn't they close that down?
Well, yeah, well, Bob, maybe you've heard of it in one of two ways. Okay, here's way number one you might have heard of it. HARP was a U.S. military funded project. It was unclassified, non-clandestine, and it was an ionospheric research program whose purpose was to analyze the ionosphere and investigate the potential for developing ionospheric enhancement technology for radio communications and surveillance. And I say was because, as you alluded to, Bob, the HARP program ended, officially ended in 2014. Now, here's another way you may have heard of it. HARP is a secret weapon of the government which has the capability of any of the following evil superpowers. Can cause earthquakes, can control the weather, can boil the atmosphere away, can disable satellites, can destroy aircraft, including TWA Flight 800 and the Space Shuttle Columbia. It can control the minds of people and orangutans, or is responsible for global warming.
Wait. People and orangutans?
I threw the orangutans thing in there.
Orangutans.
Thank you, Bob.
Yes. 10 points for Bob for picking up the...
I say it that way just to have Bob correct me every time.
And they also think HARP is not shut down. It's actually still being wielded to this day for evil purposes. So... which way do you think they're going with this particular story? So here's how the article reads. A U.S.-developed weapon system that strikes the atmosphere with a focused electromagnetic beam may cause global warming, says the government of India. And when I say the government of India, we are talking about the Environment Minister, Anil Madhav Dev. And he put this down in writing, that the U.S. has developed a type of weapon called High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It strikes the upper atmosphere with focused and steerable electromagnetic beams. It's an advanced model of a super-powerful ionospheric heater which may cause the globe to warm and have a global warming effect. Well, apparently he's not aware that it's no longer... in service, but again, there are some people who think that actually it is, and the shutting it down is just part of the great cover-up and one of the many conspiracy theories surrounding HARP. That's what you have here.
There you are, then.
And there you are. HARP is responsible for global warming.
It's interesting how something innocent like that just takes on a life of its own. Like, they get it into their head that there's something sinister about it. And that's it. There's something sinister about it. And now nothing that you could say or that will ever happen will dissuade them from that, because it all becomes part of the conspiracy.
Right. It's also interesting because we know what's responsible for global warming. It's not like that's a big open-ended question and we needed to find some sort of scapegoat. Like, we know what causes global warming. We don't know everything, but we know a lot of the picture by now.
This if you isn't believe even, that like, sort necessary. Of thing, Karen.
Oh, yeah, no. If you believe those climatologists.
I think the takeaway from this article, perhaps, is that people in high power, in high positions, in government levels and so forth, can easily get swept up in the, hysteria of conspiracy theories just as easily as any other human being on the planet.
I think some people are more easy than others, but yeah, I get your point. All right, Bob, tell us about this artificial biobot stingray cyborg whatever thing.
Cool.
Do you guys remember the classic Star Trek episode? Yes. Operation Annihilate. Operation Annihilate, where those weird flying fleshy disc shaped creatures infected Spock and killed Kirk's brother.
Yes. Yeah,
I missed that one. Dang.
Scientists actually created one of those. Well, why? But it doesn't fly. Wait, it doesn't fly. It can't infect anyone, but it can swim. And that's about all it does. But it looks like it. But it is still, it's pretty sweet. It's an incredible construct called a bio-hybrid machine, or biobot, made to look and move like a stingray. And it consists of three things: silicone gel, some gold, and genetically engineered rat cells. That's it. But it's engineered to move towards light and undulate just like a real stingray. It's a really beautiful movement. So this is the latest example of nature-inspired robotics. It was created by a team of researchers headed by Sungjin Park and Kit Parker at Harvard University's Department of Bioengineering and Applied Sciences. It's tiny. It's only a half inch long and it weighs just 10 grams. So it may not be impressive in size, but it can move realistically towards light and even be steered by changing the properties of the light hitting it. So how do you even go about making something like this? It's really four layers. This thing consists of four layers. First, you have a silicon gel that's created in a mold. So it's got this stingray shape. And this is just silicon that's just like the outer layers of breast implants. Then you put a gold skeleton inside.
What? That sounds really cool.
I would love a gold skeleton. now, the reason for this is that silicon is kind of floppy, but with the skeleton in it, it bends back into its original shape because it kind of has a shape memory. And it might sound kind of weird and expensive to have a skeleton that's made of gold. But remember, this is tiny. It's a half an inch. And it just so happens that gold so happens to have the ideal combination of stiffness and bendiness for this specific application.
Well, that sounds suggestive.
Well worth the expense. The next part is an interstitial layer of silicon that's super thin. Now, this is here for two reasons. It prevents the fourth and final layer from touching the gold. But more importantly, it has these micro patterns in it that are basically from the mold that the silicon was in, and that helps the final layer grow in the precise arrangement required. And then the layer four, the final layer, this is on the underside of the robot stingray, and this is that mouse heart cells. Now, these are aligned in a back and forth pattern from the middle kind of going outwards. So when muscle flexing starts, they move the silicon pectoral fins in an efficient stingray-like manner. Now, these just aren't some any old mouse cells that they throw onto the biobot. These are special genetically engineered cells that are tweaked so they respond to very specific frequencies of light. And this was accomplished, of course, through the new and incredibly promising field of optogenetics. We've mentioned this a bit on the show. I think it's well worth mentioning again and going into a little bit more detail. So optogenetics uses a viral vector to incorporate a gene into nerve cells. And that gene encodes for a very special light-sensitive algae proteins called channel rhodopsins and rhodopsins. And this protein is expressed in the cell membrane, which activates the cell when it's exposed to light. So you put light of a certain frequency on the cell. These channels open. It lets the ions flow in or flow out, whatever you want. And it does what the cell is designed to do. So what makes this so fascinating is that, and so efficient, is that you're able to activate neurons far more quickly than any drugs can activate them, and with far more accuracy and specificity than electrical stimulation. So it's just so much better than any other way. And so with this new powerful tool, it's already essentially being taken for granted that this is going to cause a revolution in neuroscience. It really is a huge, huge field. I think a few years ago, it was recognized as one of the top new science fields of the decade. I mean, it's really, it's big now, and it's just going to get bigger, in my opinion. But it just doesn't work on neurons. It's great for muscle cells as well. So once the cells are in place, all the researchers needed to do was flash two sources of light, one going to each fin, and this made the biobot kind of, you know, make this undulating pattern heading towards whatever the light source is. And then if you wanted to give it a turn left or right, then all you had to do was make one of those lights on one of the fins brighter or to flash more often. And there you go. You're steering a biobot stingray. So it's pretty slick.
Now, Bob, they send this thing out to kill people? Like, what do they do with it?
It's doing slavery.
It's a hunter-skiller. It's a hunter-killer biobot stingray. Unfortunately, Jay...
Wait, this could go get Steve's snake.
It could.
If the snake was in water, possibly.
Or his new outdoor cat.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of us.
Yes. But Jay, you're not going to be able to buy this for Dylan for the pool or the tub, unfortunately. The robot needs special nutrients in the fluid because these are living tissue, living cells after all. And equally important, these are just heart cells. There are no immune cells. So if you put them in your tub with Dylan, bacteria and fungi would attack them, so they would not last long in the wild. So, but the potential benefits for something like this, I think, are pretty cool. Besides general robotics advances, it can be used to learn more about heart cells. In fact, one of the researchers' goals, his overall goal in this entire project was to create artificial hearts for kids who need them. So very, very laudable goal.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's just so many applications. Adam Feinberg is a roboticist at Carnegie Mellon. He said, by using living cells, they were able to build this robot in a way that just couldn't replicate with any other material. You couldn't replicate this movement with onboard electronics and actuators while keeping it lightweight and maneuverable, and it really is remote controlled like a TV set. So you really couldn't do this using any other technology that we have right now. It would just be way too heavy. In my mind, the real question is, what is this thing? Is this BioBot alive? What the hell do you even call it besides a BioBot?
It's a cyborg.
It's a cyborg. Yeah. And in many senses it is, but one quote I got from Kit Parker, who's a bioengineer at Harvard, he led the team. He said, "I think we've got a biological life form here, a machine, but a biological life form. I wouldn't call it an organism because it can't reproduce, but it certainly is alive. And yeah, part of it consists of living cells. So in some sense, it is alive."
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Audible Audiobooks.
Audible totally rocks. I started listening in the mid-90s with an MP3 player that sold, I forget what the name was, like probably a decade before iPods. And I've just been a member ever since. It's such a wonderful place. Right now, just right today, I was listening to Neil Asher's Transformation series. Book 2, War Factory, filled with AIs. And it is just a magical book. Cool. The series, the author, I love it. And there's so many more like it all over Audible. You can get original audio shows, news, and comedy, not just regular books. It's just an amazing resource for all your audio entertainment.
You know what I love about Audible is that you can listen to a book. You can do something that's actually good for yourself pretty much anywhere. You know, if you're working out at the gym, if you, like me, live in LA and are always stuck in traffic, or if you live in a big city and you take the subway, that's a great time to listen to your favorite audiobook.
Yeah, and Carrie, you know, the app actually has cool things that you wouldn't get if you were just listening to the file on your own. Has the chapter navigation, you could do the narration speed control. And this is really cool. They let you take an audio excerpt and send it to your friend. Like if you listen to a cool thing that was in the book, you can just ping it over to one of your friends and say, hey, check this out, that was on the book.
And we want you to start a 30-day trial to download your first audiobook for free. Go to audible.com/skeptics to get started. That's audible.com/skeptics for your free 30-day trial and an audiobook.
And Bob will call you.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
All right, last week I played you my favorite noisy of the year. Ooh. This is what you listen to. Now, I bet that you guys know that I got a lot of weird email about that.
Jay,
yeah.
What does it say about you that this is your favorite noisy of the year?
It's mine as well. It's mine as well, especially once you learn what the hell it is.
Yeah, so I have to admit, I spilled my guts to Bob. It was too cool.
oh, my God.
I had to talk to him about it. Very, very cool noisy. So I'll tell you a couple of guesses I got. One of them was Ani Koski said, to Who's That Noisy? This is a hot water kettle approaching boiling temperature. And I ask you, Ani or Oni, who the hell would want their hot water kettle to scream at them like that?
I would.
A person who's hard of hearing, maybe.
I don't know. Maybe just over Halloween. I don't know. But that was funny. I got a lot of the screaming goat. I got one that was joking around about that's the noise the mob makes. You know, of them killing people, I guess. A lot of death references like that. But unfortunately, all those are incorrect. This is the correct answer. The correct answer is that is called the Aztec death whistle. And they have a few ideas of what they did with these. One of them is that they use them to pray to the wind god, one of their gods. But the one that most people believe and the one that is, I guess what most people are saying is the correct answer is that
they want to be correct.
Yeah. This is the one I want to be correct. That the Aztec warriors would blow these as they ran into battle. So you would have hundreds of warriors blowing
hundreds.
Death screaming whistles to intimidate and to shake up the army that they're running and fighting against. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think somebody stumbled on how to make a shape that makes this noise when you blow through it, because it's like a skull that you just hold in your hand, you blow like a whistle. And the idea is that the Aztec warriors would be wearing these as they run in, and then at the appropriate time, they all kind of look at each other and go, blow, and they just, freak the crap out of the army. keeping in mind that you and I and everyone here only heard one, and it was scary. Imagine hundreds of them. So,
oh, my God.
So, again, thanks, Nicholas, for sending that in. Love it, love it, love it. Think it's very cool, and there's a little historical component to it.
Jay, I looked these up. I'm going to buy one. I found
just
some
one?
That you could. That I'm signed. I'm going to buy hundreds. I found a bunch that you could buy, Jay, and they all, some of them look really, really cool. The only downside right now is that none of the ones that were for sale actually said this is how it sounds.
Yeah.
So I could just see you buy one like, oh, this sounds like a wimp. But once I find one that they will actually wisely say this is how it sounds. By the way, I'm going to buy it. It was like 50 or 60 bucks.
Maybe the guy who won, who's that noisy this week, John in Denver, can help you out, because John wrote, that's an Aztec death whistle. The Aztec armies would sound hundreds of them to frighten their opponents. I have one myself. So,
oh,
John,
no way.
Email Bob at info@theskepticsguide.org.
It says,
John, I have one. Tell us where you got it and help Bob out. He needs one of these.
Excellent. I want it for Halloween. I'm going to walk around in October and just blow that damn whistle. Imagine, Jay, imagine if I did that in the haunted corn maze when I was doing the corn maze.
I know.
That would have been freaking.
Bob, I actually thought about that, how cool that would be. That could be our lunch break sound or snack break sound. So this week's noisy, I'm doing something that I don't believe Evan ever did, and I know I've never done it. I am crowdsourcing an answer to a noisy that somebody sent in, and they don't know what it is. And I thought this would be fun.
Awesome. Okay,
yeah.
That's good.
And I think if I get more people sending them in, I'll do this more often, because I think it's a really cool idea to see our audience respond. So Lara Chavon sent in a noisy. She said, this noise was recorded by my father just before sunrise. He says he could not see the birds that are doing this noise, but it's so beautiful that I had to share it, and maybe someone will know. And
maybe
this
Steve
was
knows, Steve.
Yeah, well, I'd love that, too. That would be really cool to test Steve out. And she's in Brazil. So check this noisy out. And if you think you know what it is, or if you're 100% certain, email me and let me know. But let me know if you're guessing or if you're 100% certain, so I could try to get to the real answer here. So here are the mystery birds. What do you think, guys?
They're so cute.
I have no effing idea.
Let's see. Brazil. Toucan. No.
Steve, any guesses?
That's the first one off the list.
I'm not familiar with birds of Brazil.
What?
Well, you should be. How about the boys from Brazil?
Yeah.
All right. So to all of you people out there that want to help, if you have an idea what they are or you know for certain, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and please keep sending me in your awesome nosies.
All right. Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week is estivation. Anybody have any inside knowledge? Anybody have any guesses as to what estivation refers to?
Yeah, that's
I know
sleeping,
what it
is. Yeah, what? Sleeping during the day, isn't it?
Or, no, during the summer.
Hibernation during the summer.
Conservation.
It's when you go digging with Emilio Estevez.
It's during a hot or dry period, but nice, usually the summer, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So in zoology specifically, to estivate is to be in a dormant or inactive state, generally in a hot, dry environment. We see it in reptiles, insects, snails, even some mammals, but it is not to be confused with hibernation. That actually occurs during the winter months, and it generally lasts longer. Estivation, of course, occurs during the summer months. In botany, it also has a definition. It's the arrangement of petals and sepals in the bud of a flower before it opens. And that's as opposed to vernation, which is the arrangement of young leaves in a leaf bud before it opens. And also, because of its usage, you can kind of use estivation in a literary sense. You'll sometimes hear people refer to estivating. Like, I have friends from Texas who like to estivate in the Pacific Northwest in order to beat the heat. So that really just means summering over someplace. It's very hoity-toity. Huh.
I see.
Yes, I see. So the etymology of this word is interesting. It was first described in the early to mid 1600s in the scientific sense, and it comes from the Latin estes, which is actually the way it's typically spelled, the A-E-S-T, although the American spelling is just E-S-T. And the Latin estes literally translates to the hot season or summer. Later it became estivare, which means to spend the summer. So it's like a direct translation there from the Latin. And that's what animals do. Estivators, as I said before, are typically snails, earthworms, bees, salamanders, toads, frogs, lizards, crocodiles, some snakes, mud turtles, desert tortoises, and the mammal that I spoke of is the adorable little hedgehog. Hibernators, we all know, are some small birds and mammals, pocket mouses, pocket mice, kangaroo mice, bats, insects, and animals of that nature.
And bears.
And bears.
Oh, my.
Sweet little bears. Yes.
It's an amazing process. What their body is actually going through during the hibernation is amazing.
Yeah. Hibernation is a much more intense metabolic process than estivation, although it is what we think of as that kind of induced, long-term, minimal sort of metabolic processes.
Yeah. They had to develop the metabolic pathways to live off their body fat.
Mm-hmm.
We can't live off our body fat because we need glucose, you know.
It's a damn shame too.
But they can essentially make glucose out of fat, so they can just live off their body fat.
Wow.
And we also don't have enough of that kind of fat. Like, they have a really high proportion of brown fat and we don't. Mm.
All right. Couple quick emails. First, a follow-up. You guys, Evan, you mentioned the snake. I got a couple of emails about this. This one comes from Doug Taylor from Mill Creek, Washington. He writes, love the show and I'm a longtime listener. Occasionally you guys mention things that I'm pretty passionate about, and this time it was snakes. As an avid reptile keeper, this hit close to home for me. I agree that keeping potentially harmful wildlife from your yard is important, and I would strongly encourage you to use the methods that are at least harmful to the local reptile population. Please don't get a cat and let it outdoors. Since Dr. Novello lives next to a natural area, an outdoor cat will patrol far from the yard and kill whatever it can. Keeping a pet cat as an outdoor pet no longer is seen as a socially responsible way to keep cats. Cats are indiscriminate killers of pretty much anything they can take down and don't distinguish between native wildlife and introduced pests. The feral cat problems in Hawaii and Australia are prime examples of the extreme side of the problem. If I could suggest other solutions, put a fish pond below your bird feeder, get a Jack Russell Terrier, hang a tray below your bird feeder to catch spillage, convert your bird feeder to a hummingbird feeder. I already have a hummingbird feeder. Place lots of rodent traps, live or lethal. I'm sure there are other things I haven't thought of. Keep
but
up
don't
the
use
good
rodenticide.
Fight. So apparently Doug doesn't want me to kill a lethal snake, but wants me to slaughter rodents indiscriminately.
Sure.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Don't use rodenticide in your yard.
No.
Get a
no.
Jack Russell
it's so
Terrier.
Dangerous.
We
so,
never thought hunters. Of killing the snake. We were kidding about that. We
never said we were going to kill the snake. I did joke about getting an outdoor cat. Listen, I have two cats. They're indoor cats. I'm never going to have an outdoor cat. I agree. They are slaughterers. You know, the cats just kill. I can't have an outdoor cat and a ton of bird feeders and birdhouses. That's, you know, those things are almost incompatible.
It's a recipe for a lot of violence.
But interestingly, so I did clean up the snake condominium I had going there in my backyard.
Oh.
So I cleared out all the sticks and the rocks and the underbrush and everything, you know, from the borderland between my lawn and the woods.
You're like St. Patrick.
Yeah. I did not – no further sightings of the copperhead. It might have just been passing through, or maybe it's living somewhere else. I don't know. I haven't
seen
it again.
Maybe a raptor picked it up, flew away.
It's possible. We have hawks that also perch on the edge of our woods.
Yeah.
It's a very good place to find game. What's interesting is that I noticed in the last week or so, many fewer rodents
like dead bodies
in my yard.
Out in the backyard?
No dead bodies.
Well,
just, you know.
Fewer rodents.
To give you an example, a couple weeks ago, I walked out onto my deck and at least a dozen chipmunks went scurrying, you know. And now I barely see them. So I don't know what that means. It could
mean. Well,
they're
probably scared.
It could mean that that snake was hungry.
It could mean that snake's just been dining on it. I mean, the chipmunks are probably the perfect size for it, like little perfectly sized snacks. But
then it probably means that snake has friends because snakes don't dine that often.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it means. Just casual, not counting or anything, just casual observation. But it was dramatic. I mean, because they were literally all over the place. They have a trail through our backyard. You could actually see the trail, the chipmunks. They've matted down the grass, you know, in the pathway that they take.
That's a lot of traffic, yeah.
Are they eating your vegetables? Why don't you like the chipmunks there?
They do eat my vegetables.
They do, okay.
They eat the bird feed that falls down.
Yeah, because they're so cute.
They're cute. They're adorable. I don't mind them. Yeah. Just don't eat my stuff, man.
Yeah.
Don't eat my stash.
Yeah. Just don't eat my veggies. And you could tell because, like, all right, so I had a zucchini that was half eaten, and you could see the little tiny little bite marks all up and down the zucchini. All right, one more quick email. This one's really cool. This comes from Steve Harris, who actually frequently sends me news items. But he writes an email. It says, "It occurred to me that many of your younger listeners may have misunderstood Evan's quote of the week from Thomas Paine. The word fabulous is used by most young people as a rough synonym of excellent. Of course, in Paine's time, the primary meaning, perhaps the only ones, derived from the root fable. In the context of Evan's quote, I believe Paine had in mind the meaning given as definition 5A in the OED, resembling a fable, absurd, ridiculous, or perhaps of a narrative of the nature of a fable or myth full of fables.
Yes.
Legendary. So... yes. Which is definitely true. Okay. I've run into this kind of misunderstanding by law students when I teach as a guest lecturer. In reading old court opinions or treatises, they often misconstrue the use of the words fabulous and fantastic as indicative of the author's approval, when, of course, nothing could be further from the intent. Similarly, they sometimes understand the word artificial to have a negative connotation, when in fact, in such old texts, it is likely to mean something akin to artistic. There was, in the 18th and 19th centuries, a strong preference for the new factory-made products generated after the dawn of the Industrial Revolution over the homespun and natural. There was a strong prejudice against the latter, which were thought to be old-fashioned and unsophisticated. Thus, there was a widely held belief that man-made things are ipso facto superior to natural things, equally fallacious with and the polar opposite of the naturalistic fallacy we wrestle with today. It might be useful when using quotes from earlier eras to explain the meaning of such words in their time, when their meanings have changed so significantly. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's true. I did look it up as well. Yeah, absolutely. Like, fantastic means fantastical, not true, you know. And fabulous meant like a fable, not wonderful.
Yeah, not like, not look fabulous. At those shoes.
Yeah.
Ab fab, baby.
But it's funny how many of these words just come to mean awesome, excellent, you know, fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, I noted that too. Like, that was simply an archaic use of the word fabulous in Paine's quote.
But the other one you still mentioned, like, the one that he said his law students will sometimes screw up, it was the opposite. What was it again? It was fascinating.
Artificial.
To me. Artificial. Yeah.
Of artifice. More
like artsy.
Yeah.
Yeah, meaning artsy artistic. Fishal. That's so weird.
It is just all our bias and our narrative, you know. It's marketing. A lot of it is actually marketing.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know,
the appeal to nature or the appeal to technology or the appeal to science or whatever just creates an emotional kind of feel, a halo around some concept, you know, then it takes on a certain connotation, but that changes over time. But we're so stuck in our own time, you know, we just don't realize sometimes how much things change. All right. We have a very cool interview coming up. So let's go to that interview now. Well, joining us now is Maria Cork. Maria, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Jay in particular has been really looking forward to this interview. We've been setting this up for a couple of months. But Maria, you have a bit of an unusual job. Why don't you tell us about it?
I do. My day job is that I work in the creature effects industry over in the UK. And for the last couple of years, I've been working on episode 7 of Star Wars. And I supervise the hair department within creature effects.
Creature effects. So you make costumes.
Yep. The practical ones, nothing to do with digital. It's all the practical costumes with animatronic heads and prosthetics and that kind of side of things.
Do you do any full animatronics, or there's always a person involved?
It varies. A lot of the characters, I mean, if we're looking at that specific film on Force Awakens, there were some characters that were people with animatronic heads. Some of them were completely puppets that were puppeteered from outside. Some of them were just hand puppets. There was a complete mix of different things.
And what did you primarily work on?
As you can probably guess from the sort of job that I do with the hair work, most of the build involved us working on Chewbacca.
On Chewbacca.
Ah! Oh my God. All right, first I want to, Steve, you know, you didn't even properly welcome her. I was totally expecting Steve to do this.
Well, oh God, Steve.
Did my lightsaber is out of juice.
All right, hang on. No. Hang on.
Oh,
hang on.
Oh my God. Here's, I got to recharge. He's got his. Oh my God. That hasn't happened to me before.
Okay, you ready? Jay has saber envy now.
Oh my God. Like, my battery lasted for like 6 months.
Oh yeah, that's yours,
Jay,
Steve.
It happens to every guy. You can't get it on.
I really need to go see a Jedi doctor.
Mine's actually right behind you, Maria, hanging on the wall.
Oh, hang on a minute. Have I got time to grab it?
Yeah.
There you go.
Are we going to have a virtual saber fight now?
Oh, absolutely. I've already started.
So
yeah, you just stick it back in. There you go.
There we go.
So amazing. Can you tell us, how did you start with that career? Like, how do you become a hair specialist? Where did it begin?
When I was a teenager, I was one of the people who was completely obsessed with horror films and anything along that genre. So I used to watch all of those and go, I really wanted to do effects. And I used to love all the magic as well. It kind of went hand in hand. And I started doing silly makeup slit wrists on friends at school when I was about 14, 15 and annoying the teachers. And then I got my first work experience at a small model making company near my house and then started working at Shepperton Studios one day that I had off while I was doing college. And as soon as I finished at 18, I started as a runner in a special effects workshop and worked my way up and spent a lot of time at Jim Henson's Creature Shop, which was my first kind of big break in the industry as the runner, and worked my way up through that company.
So did you learn your skills mainly like as an apprentice, or is there like, did you get a degree in making Wookiees?
That came much later, but early on, I didn't go to university. I just kind of knew what I wanted to do and started literally as the person who would run out and buy all of the goods for the special effects companies and go to haberdashery shops and sculpting supplies, and then started to get the work, doing a bit of seaming of the skins and painting and helping out and doing whatever I could. And then eventually specialized in hair when we did Animal Farm at Jim Henson's Creature Shop for an HBO TV series. And we had lots of animatronic pigs to make. And I was doing a lot of the hair work on that. And after 6 months of that, kind of went, yeah, I think I know how to do this. I think I can do more of this.
But it's quite an honor to be the person on the planet that got to, you know, put the hair on the Chewbacca costume. I mean, I find that to be pretty profound. Like, you have to be amazingly good at this.
I've been doing it for a while now. And even when I got that phone call, because the guy who's my boss, Neil Scanlon, who's heading up the creatures department, I've worked with a lot in the past. We did Sweeney Todd and we did Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and lots of other jobs together. But when he called me for that one, and it was always from the outset, he said, we have to make Chewbacca. It's terrifying. It's daunting. It's a legacy character that everyone loves, and you don't want to be the one that doesn't do the right job of it. There's a big weight on my shoulders as soon as I took the job.
I bet. But seeing your work on the screen, though, I mean, being a part of that film and everything, I mean, that's history.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that I've never experienced in my job before. We make things all the time, and someone will go, oh, yeah, I saw that severed head you did in this TV show, and then it all moves on. But this is something really different. I mean, I was just saying to Cara before you guys came online, we did the Star Wars Celebration this Saturday, which was at the Excel Center. It's like a kind of Comic-Con, but specifically for Star Wars. And the creature department heads all did a panel talk for 4,000 people. That's not something you normally do in my industry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. How was the conference? Like, was it incredible?
It was amazing. I'm so happy. Warwick Davis headed our panel, so he was kind of looking after it and introducing us all, and it was more of a conversation. So that was great because he's brilliant at that kind of thing, and he put us all at our ease, and plus we already know him because we put him in costumes quite a lot. So that was good. But it was just an experience. I've never had anything like that, walking out into a room with 4,000 people who love the work you've done. Well, you hope so anyway.
And what were you saying to me before we started recording? Nowhere else in the world will you see like a man in a Princess Leia bikini.
Yep. I think my favorite, there were two costumes that I loved that I saw on Saturday. There was a beautiful Asian lady with full beauty makeup on in an Obi-Wan Kenobi outfit with a stuck-on beard, which was just fantastic. And then there was also a guy who'd done his own Chewbacca outfit, and it was just a cardboard tube and a cardboard kind of just thing, that like a poncho that he put over his head, and it just painted Chewie on it, and it was just brilliant. I love it.
But so Cara, I bet you that's not literally true.
Literally. I bet you there are plenty
of places where you would see guys in Princess Leia outfits.
Yeah, I bet you there's like a whole dark corner of the internet just
you could actually pay for that.
I think
there's probably about 500 of them down in San Diego at the moment, isn't there? Just getting ready for the weekend.
Oh, yeah, already in line.
So to do the work that you do, so they gave you the bodysuit with no hair on it. You just got handed this. What material was the suit made out of?
So the bodysuit itself is a lycra suit. The original one they used in the film in A New Hope was knitted, but we decided to go with lycra just for longevity because we knew how much we were going to have to film on this film. So it was a lycra suit that came to us, and we would pattern out where the blends are, so the color changes from ginger into the gray mix. And we would just knot the hairs in one or two at a time using a tiny little crochet hook, double knotted in the same way that they make high-end wigs.
Oh, my God. How long did that take?
Well, we made 5.5 suits in total because there were 3 different people playing Chewbacca in the film. We had Peter Mayhew, obviously. We did 1.5 suits for him. So we did a half one for when he sat in the Falcon, just because it's easier to dress him and just for his own comfort. And then we had a photo double who was a guy called Yonas Suetamo. And we also had Ian White, who was a stunt double. And each of those guys had 2 suits each, because for every day that we filmed on a suit, it had to go back to the workshop and 2 people had to spend a day getting the knots out and restyling it every day. So,
oh, wow.
I'm trying to think how long that took in total. We think at the peak of the build, we had 13 people in the hair department, and they were generally just knotting the suits. And that was for about 6 months.
But then
we had about a year's development before that, or 6 months development before that, just to get to the point where we knew what we were doing and could get on with it.
So there was a moment where you finished the first suit. I'm just assuming that this happened. And did you guys like have this moment where you finished the first one and you just stood back and went, oh my God, it's gorgeous?
I think we carried on developing the whole time, even when we'd done, because the suit's one thing, but the head is a whole nother ball game, because the head is consists of the sculpt. So the first thing we did was try and get the head and the face right. So Luke Fisher in the sculpting and concept department spent quite a bit of time sculpting a head, and then I'd get it and put some hair on it. Then we'd look at it, figure out what wasn't right, go back. He'd change the sculpt, then I'd put hair on it again. So that was our first thing, trying to make that right. And even once you've got the completed head done, just the styling of it changes, because Chewbacca moves his head. I think I said this in the panel on Saturday. He has a tendency to tuck his chin down and move his head left and right. And as he does, the hair on his chin kind of puffs out and he stops looking like Chewbacca. So then we started sewing bits of the hair down to the cowl with invisible threads and things, just to try and keep it all in shape. But it was a real monster task. We got as much reference as we could from the original film and stills and video footage and things, and just worked with everything and picked out photos we liked that captured the essence of Chewie and tried to just kind of make that. It was always our brief to try and make it look and feel like Episode 4 Chewbacca.
Yeah, now you guys didn't, or the people who made the actual head didn't add anything to it, right? Didn't you say when you and I talked a couple of months ago, they wanted it to be identical to movies 4, 5, and 6, right?
Yeah, I mean, we could have tried to add. I think there was talk at the start of maybe adding eyebrow movements and other things, but because it's such a legacy character and because it's Chewie and all he had was its real eyes and he opens his mouth and there's 2 paddles in the top lip that causes lips to go up into a snarl, but that automatically happens as he opens his mouth. That's all we did. We didn't add any more. You can just lose the character. And things that come up on the internet quite a bit is people going, why didn't you age him? And it was always the brief. Again, it came from JJ. It was kind of, we just need to make him look like Episode 4. Plus, you know, the folklore of Wookiees is they live to about 400 years old and he was, what, 200 in Episode 4? Yeah. So he's only going to be 230 in Episode 7. So specifically trying to age him, I think, might have looked like we were trying too hard, I think.
Were you personally on set? Like every day? Like what was the job like?
Once we'd finished the build and we started shooting, I was looking after, Chewbacca every day that we shot. So we did about, I think, 40 or 50 shoot days on that film. There were days when we'd have 2 Chewbaccas up. So Peter Mayhew would be doing something and then we'd also have Yonas standing by, or we'd have Ian White standing by for a stunt. So then we had another team from the hair department and I'd always be on set with somebody from fabrication. So they would help dress. So there were 2 of us, but I'd go and do the makeup in the morning and black his eyes out. And then we'd both dress him in a tent on set and I'd look after him on the actual shoot.
So are you like standing behind the camera and every time like the actor does something that screws the suit up, you're like, oh, don't do that. What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was the bane of the AD's life because I was always the last person out when they were going to start rolling. Because, you know, he'd shake his head and suddenly you were trying to keep some semblance of continuity throughout. And, it's hair. It does move around. That was fine. But we had to try and keep it. And sometimes this one bit would just fall across his face every time. And they'd be like, yeah, go on. We know you're going to go in. Go on. Yeah. Do it.
So when you watch the final movie now, do you see anything like, oh, we should have brushed the hair to the left? Oh, what? You know, like you have that type of stuff going on too?
I think the first time I watched the film, which was at the crew screening, which was the first time we got to see it, just before it was released, I think it was about 5 hours before it was released, they'd hired a cinema just for the crew throughout the day to go and see it. I was just, you focus on the things that you did. But then the second time I watched it, I kind of relaxed from it. And I realized you have to, you've done what you can do. And it's a 7'6" wig, and there's only so far you can go with it. And, you try your hardest.
Was that all human hair? Did you say that?
It's not human hair. It's yak belly hair, which is what they use a lot to make theatrical beards from. It's a little bit coarser. And yeah, as it says, it's from the belly of a yak, but it's quite commonly available for theatrical things.
Oh, really?
And it's what the original suit was made of as well. So again, we just didn't want to change anything around.
I have a sweater that's like wool and yak, and it's really warm.
Yak's like, quite coarse. I mean, maybe that's the top part of the hair. If you look at a yak, it's got this strip of really long hair under its belly, and then its tail hair is even coarser and longer. So they use that for beard hair in theaters quite a lot.
I definitely know when I wear that sweater, I feel hot.
They do live in Tibet and Nepal, so that makes sense.
Is the full costume very, very warm?
Compared to some of the other costumes that people are in that film, which are made of foams and they're really big and hefty. At least with this one, if we put air conditioning on him or if we put a fan on him, it goes through the hair, through the lycra suit, and he can feel it. Some of the guys who were in the much bigger fabricated suits don't feel any benefit of any air, so they're just stuck in there. Or the guys in fabrication put fans in there to get airflow going, just to keep them cool.
Ugh, those suits must smell so bad.
We use our secret weapon is vodka and tea tree oil at the end of every day. Things that you can't put through the wash, we spritz them with vodka and tea tree. So all the time production are like, you can't get alcohol on the production budget. We're like, honestly, we're not drinking it. I promise.
You're like, you just pour vodka all in the suit and everything's great.
Yeah, it's good. It's an antibacterial and the tea tree smells good and is also an antibacterial. It works really well.
You know, we forgot to mention that you're close friends with Richard Wiseman, and he set this interview up for us. He made the connect. He actually turned to me during a live recording and said, I've got a dead dog in my garden. Now, after he said that.
I've seen where the dead dog is. I have seen that. I've been to his house. I know all about the dead dog. Trust me.
After he said that, he was like, oh, my God, Jay, I have someone you have to talk to. And I'm like, and he told me what the deal was, and I lost my mind. I'm like, are you kidding? Like, yes, make that happen. So I want to thank Richard for making the connection. And I want to thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us. And I'm sure that you made about at least a solid 50% of our audience super psyched to hear all this awesome info about the movie.
Oh, thank you so much. No, it's been an absolute pleasure to come on here. And I'll do anything for Richard. He's a sweetheart.
So, you know, if by any chance you happen to work on a Star Wars movie again, nobody knows, could you please come back and chat with us again, maybe next year or you know, whenever?
If I ever get the chance to work on another Star Wars film, I shall put it in the diary.
Excellent.
Excellent. All right. Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you, Maria.
You're so welcome.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Yes.
All right.
See.
Three regular news items this week. Item number one, a new study finds that heating milk by 10 degrees Celsius for less than 1 second extends the shelf life from 3 weeks to 10 weeks. Item number two, a new analysis concludes that the moon's Imbrium Basin was formed much more recently than previously assumed, as recently as 10 million years ago. And item number three, researchers have demonstrated that humans can detect a single photon of light. Bob, go first.
Heating milk by 10 degrees Celsius in for less than 1 second. So basically,
I would say, let me say, this is in addition to pasteurization, because with pasteurization, you get to 3 weeks. Yeah, just to be make that clear.
Heating it by 10 degrees. So does that mean that you're rapidly increasing the temperature within 1 second? Or just you get it up 10 degrees hotter for 1 second? That's probably what it means. It seems like an obvious overdramatic result for just such a simple thing. So, oh well, can't think of a reason. Yeah. Oh well, let's go to the second one. The moon's Imbrium Basin was formed much more recently than previously assumed. 10 million. I'm not familiar. So what can you tell me? Yeah, I guess you won't give me too much more detail about that basin.
That's the right eye of the man in the moon.
10 million years ago. Cool. So they used to think that those basins, so the seas, right? The Maria, the seas, that they were yeah, caused by impacts that kind of fractured the crust, and then this lava kind of seeped out and spread over. But now I think the conventional wisdom is that these were just eruptions, basalt eruptions, which are impressive eruptions. They have happened on the Earth. They are wow. Okay. Oh, I'm not buying that one. Let's see. Let's look at the third one. A single photon of light. Damn. You know, I've heard both for years. I've heard both that we can detect a single photon, and that and then other people say no, it's not, you know, as granular as one single photon. But now they're saying we can. All right. I'm gonna go with the moon. Moon fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The one about the heating the milk. I think this one makes a lot of sense. They're not saying you heat it and you leave it at that temperature. You're heating it up really quick, killing off whatever is in there, you know, bacteria, whatnot. And then it'll just increase the shelf life. So it's as part of the pasteurization process, which I just thought when they pasteurize something that they're kind of doing that. But this is like a specific temperature and everything. I mean, sure. So, okay, I really don't have any reason to not believe that one. You know, the one about the Imbrium Basin, it is interesting because to think that what would you call that, Steve?
Feature.
Thank you. Perfect word, Evan.
But it's a Maria.
That feature, you know, could have only originated, you know, less than 10 million years ago. That's not a lot of time when you think about, you know, just how much time the moon has existed. Interesting. And I'd like to know why they think that. If there's a study here, I'd like to read that. And this last one about the humans being able to see one photon of light, I completely believe that. I think that that's an absolute given. So it's between the milk and the moon's Imbrium Basin, and I drink milk, so therefore I'm an expert on it. And, and since I have not been to or eaten the cheese from the moon, I'm going to say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Okay, heating milk by 10 degrees Celsius for less than 1 second. I still don't know how you accomplish that, like physically, how do you accomplish? Because it's either, like Bob said, heating it up 10 degrees within a second or within less than a second's time, or heating it up to 10 degrees and letting it sit there for less than a second, but then like it would stay that warm for longer than a second. I don't know. I'm confused by this one. Yeah, then you have to super chill it like less than a second later. Yeah, I don't know. I always thought the shelf life was already long, so that doesn't seem too unreasonable. The Imbrium Basin on the moon, well, the moon is, gosh, I hope I'm not wrong here. The moon's like almost the same age or around the same age as the Earth, and that's 4.5 billion years old. So 10 million is really recent. And I would think that a feature that's that pronounced that you can see with your naked eye is huge. So if something like that happened only 10 million years ago, I would think that there would be other outcomes of that in the solar system of an impact that big. Like it would actually change its trajectory or something. I don't know. It that seems too soon to me. And then humans can detect a single photon of light. I buy it. Can't we see like a candle at a distance of a mile or 5 miles or 10? I don't remember, on a clear night. Like we have really good vision, better than any of our other senses. So I'm going to say that, yeah, I'm going to GWBJ.
Whoa.
And
hey,
and I'm going to say that the Imbrium Basin is the fiction.
And Evan.
The reason I think the milk one is science is that, yes, they did figure this one out. The reason it's not being implemented is because of, you know, like anything else, cost analysis. It probably costs too much to go through whatever sudden heating process and then cooling process would be involved. Not worth it. They couldn't. They'd have to sell milk for $20 a gallon or something. So, but in as a proof concept, yes, that does work. The one about humans detecting a single photon of light. They didn't say every human, but some humans and people who have, you know, very, very perhaps clear. It's clear or as pure a vision as you can possibly have. They can probably see the photon of light. That leaves the moon. The moon's left. So that's fiction. I'm going with the team.
All right, well, let's take these in order. A new study finds that heating milk by 10 degrees Celsius for less than 1 second extends the shelf life from 3 weeks to 10 weeks. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. This is a science. Yes. So the shelf life of milk just with ordinary pasteurization is 2 to 3 weeks, which is fine. I mean, we go through a gallon of milk in, you know, like 4 or 5 days. So
you have a family. Single person has a harder time with that.
Yeah, by a quart then.
Big milk is taking advantage of this.
I know.
But there are people who live in remote areas where the milk has to go farther. And by the time the milk gets there, it has a very short shelf life left. But in any case, extending the shelf life of milk would be nice. So what the researchers did was they used a low temperature, short time, or LTST method. This is a Purdue study. First, they inoculated the milk with lactobacillus and pseudomonas. They heated it in a pressurized chamber, rapidly raising and then lowering the temperature by about 10 degrees Celsius. But this was still, it was low temperature, still below the 70 degrees Celsius threshold needed for pasteurization. So they didn't raise the temperature beyond what's already done in pasteurization. This extended the shelf life to 63 days. It decreased the number of bacteria. That's basically how it works. Decreased the number of bacteria to below detectable levels. The fewer bacteria, the longer it takes those bacteria to reach the numbers necessary to alter the milk, to spoil the milk. They tested the resulting milk with panelists who detected no differences in color, aroma, taste, or aftertaste. So it seems to not affect the quality of the milk, but just extends the shelf life. So, yeah,
so it's a shock. It's like the rapid rise and drop.
I guess so.
Shocks the shit
I guess
out
so.
Of
more testing needed, I think.
You could also just irradiate the milk and kill all the bacteria. Then you could store it on your cupboard shelf. You don't need to put it in the refrigerator.
Well, they do. There are milks that you can buy that are shelf stable.
Yeah, it's irradiated. Yeah. It doesn't make it radioactive. It just
it. It's not ionizing radiation that's coming.
Yeah. All right, here we go. Number two, a new analysis concludes that the moon's Imbrium Basin was formed much more recently than previously assumed, as recently as 10 million years ago. All of the rogues quite confidently feel that this one is the fiction, and this one is... the fiction.
Yeah, baby. Oh, sweet.
Moon.
Good job, everyone.
Yay.
And you guys hit upon the reasons why this is fiction. The main basins on the moon, the mare, the black areas, were formed during the era of heavy bombardment.
Yeah, it was
billions of years ago. Yeah, about 4 billion years ago, including the Imbrium Basin. And for this one, for the Imbrium one, there's a clear evidence of a massive crater, of a massive impact. Not just a crater, but I mean, they have the markings left on the surface of the moon by the debris from whatever impacted it.
The ejecta.
Yeah, exactly. So what their analysis did show was that the asteroid that formed the Imbrium Basin was about 10 times as massive as we previously thought. It was protoplanet sized. It was big enough that it was actually a protoplanet, not just an asteroid. So it was about twice as big and about 10 times as massive as previous estimates. That was the actual news item. So it was, cracked open the crust of the moon, caused the basaltic eruption and formed that sea. Okay, let's go on to item number three. Researchers have demonstrated that humans can detect a single photon of light, which is, of course, science. This was a controversy for a while, Bob. People didn't know what the lower limit of human light detection
was. That's why I heard both, I guess.
Yeah. Now, it actually was known that a retinal neuron could respond to a single photon, but what was not known was whether or not that would be perceived by the brain, because would that signal make its way to the brain? Because the brain may filter out background noise, and that a single photon would just be eliminated with the noise. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What they did was they put subjects into a very dark room for like 40 minutes, let them completely dark adapt, and then they would look into a device, you know, that would either emit a photon or not emit a photon. And they had to say whether or not they saw the photon. They had to do it this way because 90% of the photons would not make it through to the retina, right? They would get scattered by the lens, the cornea, the vitreum, you know, the fluid in there. So they had to do a statistical analysis to see if they detected the photon more often than you would predict by chance. And they did, significantly so. So they were able to detect a single photon. They describe it as like you almost don't really see it. You just have this vague sensation that something happened. You know what I mean? It doesn't like create an image. They said it was a very bizarre experience. Like they just like, you know, barely on the edge, obviously, of detection, but it's almost like just you have this sense that something happened, you know?
Oh, and I misspoke when I said mile. It was 30 miles. A human can see a candle flame 30 miles away on a clear night.
Yeah.
Wow, that is far.
Wow.
If you were like up high, obviously, because you would lose the horizon if you were like at sea level.
Yeah, the horizon's 15 miles away. Yeah. So yeah, you wouldn't. So good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Yay.
Yeah, the 10 million years. That was, that was
very implausible.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right, here we go. Denialists maintain their stance, be it in regards to HIV and AIDS, the Holocaust, or 9/11, in the face of exhaustive and irrefutable evidence. It is not melodramatic to say that vocalization of these particular falsehoods have been responsible for many deaths. Too true, too true. Science writer Ben Vincent wrote those words as part of an article back in 2009, titled When Pseudoscience Kills, Trust Denialism and Peter Duisberg.
Yeah.
Very good article and a very good reminder that there are very serious consequences when people give in to the ways of pseudoscience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Duisberg is a scientist who is an HIV denialist. He's like basically the head, you know, of HIV denial. He's the only,
right, the poster child.
Yeah, he gives it whatever respectability it has, you know, or at least plausibility. But
I wonder how you get on in your life to denying HIV. Like, I can understand to a certain degree being a global warming denier, but like, why would you deny HIV?
Yeah, because there's good rhetoric around that. Yeah. There's like enough people kind of on your team. But yeah, how big is the HIV denial movement and how gross is it? You know what I mean?
Oh, it's
honestly, a lot of them are dead. And I mean that seriously. A lot of the people who had HIV and or HIV deniers didn't take the medication, and now they're dead.
Yeah.
So that actually took a huge toll on the HIV denial movement. A lot of the big, you know, people who are like, I'm living with HIV, and I'm, you know, I don't have AIDS, and blah, 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 now they're dead.
Oh, okay. And that the would make sense as a motivation for it, because you don't want to admit to yourself that you're so sick.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks.
Sure.
Death by denial.
Yeah.
Yep. The words hoist and petard come to mind in that context. Yeah.
Well, that was a bummer ending.
Well, no.
Thanks, Evan.
I mean to bring everyone down on that one. It's just a friendly public service reminder that pseudoscience kills.
That's everyone. That's a running theme on our show, pseudoscience kills. That's okay. But okay, we'll end on a positive note.
Let's.
Bob, tell everybody what the SGU is doing on July 31st.
We are going on a tour of the original full sets used for the classic Star Trek show that were recreated, lovingly recreated to millimeter scale perfection in Ticonderoga, New York, and they're used on the Star Trek Continues web series that continues the original voyage of the Star Trek Enterprise with Kirk, Spock, McCoy, all those guys. So yeah, we're just so excited. I've seen the shows. The show's really cool. The sets are exquisite. I've seen a walkthrough of the entire set. You walk through, everything is there. You can just walk from the bridge to the turbo shaft to the sick bay and to the transport. Everything is there, just all connected. It's wonderful. So we're all excited. We're going to go on the tour July 31st at 10 a.m. in Ticonderoga. And many of us will be in costume. And we're all so excited.
just like we did when we saw the Star Wars opening, we're going to auction off two of the tickets that we have to lucky SGU listeners who want to join us for a day of Star Trek geeking out and tour an incredible that's another word, actually, whose meaning has probably changed, but an incredible, fantastic, fabulous recreation of the Star Trek Enterprise, the Starship Enterprise. So, yeah, so join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you want to go, then email your bid to info@theskepticsguide.org. Put Star Trek auction in the subject and just give us your number. So, we're going to auction off the two tickets individually. So we'll just take the two highest bids. If you want to bid for both tickets, go right ahead. You know, chances are if you are going to win one, if you have the same bid for both, you'll win both. So just tell us if you're bidding for one ticket or for both. Again, we'll just take the two highest bids and then we'll let you know. You're responsible for your own transportation, of course. We'll just meet you there. So, and you got to do this right away because, it's next weekend. So send in those bids if you want to join us for a day at the Starship Enterprise.
Woohoo.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Anytime, Steve.
Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.